Talking Joe is on the air.
And it's Skybound, the Walking Dead guy. Everyone calm down, it's the invincible Bat Skybound.
It's me, Mark, and you are listening to Talking Joe, coming to you live and direct on tape from the Energon universe. Now, if you are new to Talking Joe, you can find out all about us over at our website, talkingjoe.co.uk. In a nutshell, we have been going 5 years doing weekly podcasts all about the wonderful world of G.I. Joe comics. But I don't do it alone. As always, joining me today, it's a real American nightmare. It's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners. And hello, Duke. It's so good to see you.
Indeed. Today, we will be looking at Duke, issue one. It's the first G.I. Joe issue, dedicated issue from Skybound, from their new Energon universe. It came out 27th of December in the distant past. The year 2023. Do you remember 2023, Tim?
I do. That was the year with almost no G.I. Joe comics.
It was. But most importantly, the year that they came back. So it's great to see G.I. Joe back. It's great to see the second of the three different comics coming out from, well, second of three by the end of January comics from Skybound. We're living in amazing times. But before we get into Duke, just talking topically, Tim, have you received in the post a copy or possibly even several copies of the amazing Art of G.I. Joe Omnibus by 3D Joes / Carson Metaxas?
I have. Don't forget Chad Hukal, who co-put that book together.
Indeed.
I have. It is the largest book I own, and I've got that really giant Pierre Lambert Mickey Mouse book that Hyperion did 20 years ago, and I've got some artist editions. It is the largest book that I own, and it is the heaviest book that I own, and it's amazing.
It is indeed amazing. Head on over to 3djoes.com if you do not have a copy, and find the links. It's in terms of G.I. Joe art, particularly art of the toys, it's, I guess, the first and last word now. In terms of all of that amazing painted packaging art, particularly, it's astonishing. If you've not heard of it, not seen it, seek it out. I think at some point this weekend, I will be taking it with the help of several other members of my family into the kitchen and laying it out there and reading it on the kitchen table, which is kind of what it demands. Okay, but we are not having a dedicated podcast just talking about this amazing book today. We are talking about Duke, the first entry for the G.I. Joe universe from the Energon universe from Skybound. So some context here. We've got G.I. Joe, a real American hero. This is not part of this shared Energon universe. That is written by Larry Hammer. We've had issue 302 of that. That's continuing. It's the same continuity that's continued on from G.I. Joe issue 1 in 1982, continued through Marvel to 155, was picked up at IDW to 300, and is continuing. This is not that universe. This Skybound Energon universe consists currently of Duke, Void Rivals, which was the starting point, Transformers. It will be joined by Cobra Commander, and two further limited series before we get into what is likely to be a G.I. Joe ongoing series. So this isn't the first time we've seen Duke either. He was introduced in the pages of Transformers issue 2, where there was a 5-page sequence which features Duke and Starscream, and it's been condensed into a slightly shorter sequence during Duke issue 1. So if you've not seen it, you're not missing out, because they do sort of revisit it, although it's interesting to see it from a different lens, different artist. Tim, I'm assuming that you've read issue 2 of Transformers ahead of reading issue 1 of Duke.
Yeah, I've also read issue 3 of Transformers because I'm a big Transformers fan. And as we record this, Transformers number 4 will be on sale in just a few days.
Excellent.
Transformers is great.
Yeah, I'm collecting Transformers as well for pretty much the first time since I was buying it as a Marvel UK weekly comic, because it had Action Force in there as a backup strip. So I've appreciated Transformers, but it's never been my bread and butter. But I am picking it up for this new iteration.
I think what is key here is not just to differentiate the Energon universe continuity from the Larry Hama Marvel originated continuity, or the Devil's Due continuities or the IDW continuity, but to point out that this is the first new G.I. Joe continuity we've had in a while. So the, you know, when did the G.I. Joe started at IDW in, was it 2009?
I think it was 2008.
2008.
But anyway, thereabouts, yeah.
And so that was a new continuity, and initially that was it by itself. And then 8 years later, editorial made an interesting decision that existing G.I. Joe continuity could in fact link up with the then adjacent and separate Transformers continuity. And all along the way, IDW also looked at the animated continuity with the Saturday Morning Adventures miniseries and, what was it, Future Noir, which was published as a two-parter and then was collected as a little graphic novel. And then there are some stories by people like Rob Liefeld and
Joe Fife.
Thank you. Where you could take it or leave it that it is in the Larry Hama Marvel continued continuity that IDW was publishing.
And significantly as well, there was a sort of 12-issue maxi series from writer Paul Allor, which again was its own sort of rebooted G.I. Joe continuity, where G.I. Joe was an underground resistance fighting against the tyrannical Cobra, you know, forces that were in a position of power in that continuity. So again, a different sort of interesting lens. But yeah, as you were saying, Tim, here we are.
Yeah, so I just want to take note that, I mean, Transformers, I'm used to a new continuity every 3 years between a new show, a new movie, a new sort of reboot in the toy line. And like, because for many years, the toy line had sort of a 3-year cycle. And there have been so many Transformers comics miniseries that have been sort of what-ifs and one-offs. And if you were to count now, G.I. Joe has had a lot of continuities. But at first blush, when I think, oh, G.I. Joe's had, you know, 3 or 4 continuities. But yes, the number's a lot larger than that. But it's not as large as a lot of other brands that have been around as long, because one or two or three of them have been so prominent. And so I just want to take note that it's a big deal that not just a new one is starting, because there have been new ones, but a new one that I think is A, going to last, and B, is going to be done well. So I'm very excited.
Absolutely. So who are the folks who are going to do this well? So the creative team is writer Joshua Williamson, who is a big deal at DC. So he's, you know, writing Superman, Dark Ride, various other things. Do you want to tell us a little bit about writer Joshua Williamson and kind of...
Yeah, Joshua Williamson was first on my radar because of a creator-owned series he wrote at Image called Nailbiter. We have a big horror section at my store, and one of my employees particularly is a big horror fan and is the guy who recommends horror when someone comes in and asks. Nailbiter ran, I think, the paperbacks. I think there are 7 or 8 of them. The story wrapped up. There was a very short revival a couple years ago, which is not a new volume one, but it's like the next numbered volume. And then Joshua Williamson was on my radar because he wrote a well-received run on The Flash, which went relatively long. And then last year and 2 years ago, he wrote a short Batman arc and Dark Crisis, which was revealed to actually be called Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths And that was the event miniseries for DC in 2023, quickly followed up by another event miniseries by Joshua Williamson called Night Terrors, spelled with a K, like Batman. And Joshua Williamson has seemed to be, with maybe two other writers at DC in the last 3 years, sort of the prime mover. And I don't know if that's an editorial decision or if it just sort of ends up looking that way. Because if you pitch a miniseries that gets, you know, that becomes the main miniseries, and if you also get to write Batman and you also get to write an issue of Justice League, suddenly it feels like you're at the center of a comic book publisher's universe.
And it feels like he's one of these creators as well that, you know, as a prime creator, he can get things done that he wants to have. He can get things off the ground. He talked about saying to DC that he thinks that there should be a Green Arrow book. And they were like, yeah, and you should write it. And you go, well, I don't have enough time. I'm writing too many things already. Well, kind of, it's got to be you or it's not going to happen. And you're like, oh, well, I suppose I love Green Arrow. I really want to have a Green Arrow book. I'd really like to write one. I don't have enough time, but let's go. That kind of thing.
Indeed. So Joshua Williamson was a surprise pick for me when he was announced as the person writing Duke, Cobra Commander, and these next two miniseries, and I assume what will be a G.I. Joe monthly written by him to come after that. My guess it's going to be called Codename G.I. Joe.
Mm.
And I thought, oh, well, this is really lucky because Joshua Williamson has some heat because of these high-profile projects he's done at one of the big two. But he also has a lot of sort of creator cred for doing several well-received creator-owned books at Image, and yet he also seems to be able to write many books a month, which is, you know, great. You know, I'm sort of not worried that any of these books are going to be delayed or they'll be co-written by someone because, you know, the writer is slow. And I think everyone in the last couple of years has played a little game where they think, oh, well, who would write G.I. Joe if it weren't Larry Hama? Or who would write G.I. Joe if it was a new continuity? And, you know, there are some names that get batted around, people who've been in comics longer, people who've been in comics not as long, people who haven't really done comics, but maybe are known for TV or for books. And this is not someone who I would have picked, you know, my first 10 or 20 names. But once he got picked, I thought, oh, this is very exciting because this guy's been around. He's written a bunch of good stuff. He's done a bunch of different kinds of things and he's popular.
Yeah. And he's also been willing to promote the hell out of this book. He's done an awful lot of interviews and podcasts talking about Duke and Cobra Commander and some interesting nuggets that sort of I picked up on from some of those conversations were that the conversations with Skybound started quite a long time ago. He's talked about sort of 5-6 years ago where he was talking to Sean Makowitz, who seems to be a sort of key editorial force at Skybound, who's credited here as editor. And he basically said to him that to come over and work on a licensed book, he'd only do one, and that would be G.I. Joe. And so that was sort of like a thought bubbling away in the background for them. And he said that even back then that Robert Kirkman had this kind of void rivals idea of if he was to get the license and introduce Transformers, it would be via this stealth reveal as the final page turn on an unrelated book. So that idea has obviously been there in the background for quite a long time. And so why G.I. Joe is the one licensed book? He was a massive fan of G.I. Joe since childhood. And he's kept a G.I. Joe notebook of story ideas. He's also a collector of classified toys and has pretty much all of the classified toys that have come out. And he very much likes the aesthetic for those and has talked about classified being the visual touchstone, really, for the design of the characters in this book, as we'll probably talk about in a little bit. So before he formally joined, Skybound had a pitch document to Hasbro as to the sort of the bigger story and how that all connected that they wanted to establish. And that was sort of set really by Kirkman. So he came into this with parameters and guide rails that he kind of worked within, but it was very collaborative how to do that. So I think Kirkman's idea was, let's start with Duke as a kind of entry point character, famous, and build out from there. So this is the reader's entry point into the G.I. Joe Energon universe. Talked about the fact that he's balancing this feeling of babysitting a property that he doesn't own versus ownership and investing himself into it. And I think 30 odd years plus probably of love for G.I. Joe, having these ideas bubbling away in the back of his head about what he would do if he did have the book, talking about potentially writing these stories for many years to come. It does sound like he's, truly invested in it. And the other thing that I noted about was just the Tom Riley and his relationship to this project was that he worked with Joshua Williamson as the writer on the project Superman Night Terrors. So this isn't the first time that they've worked together. And since then, they've been talking about what project they would do next. And almost independently, the Skybound team and Joshua Williamson both suggested Tom Riley as the artist for this book. And so I think it was that good relationship that helped it to come about. That's my in-the-nutshell summary of many hours of interview listening, Tim.
that's great. I had not known much of that, and I had sort of been hoping something like some of that was true. We should also point out that colorist Jordi Belair has colored a ton of stuff for Marvel, DC, Image, and others in the last 10 or so years, has also written a few comics, but is mostly known as a color artist.
Eisner Award-winning colorist.
Yes, thank you. And is known for not just being a good color artist, but for being a very thoughtful color artist, thinking about what color can do for a scene, for a project. And I'll have an example of that or two from this comic a little later in the show.
Spoilers. The color's amazing. So let's get back on track. Creative team, artist Tom Riley, colorist Jordi Belair, letterer is Russ Wooten, editors Sean Makowitz and Jonathan Manning, logo and publication design from Andre Juarez and Gillian Crab Production. These are all labeled as additional field of operatives in the credits, which has got this kind of confidential yellow styling to it, which sort of ties up to the back cover, which says, "Caution, the contents of this book is confidential. This unauthorized disclosure of information within is prohibited."
I want to point out, this is not a $3.99 comic book. This is a $4.99 comic book. And this is a 30-page story, which is also how Transformers number one launched before settling into its proper $3.99 regular length format, and how Cobra Commander will also launch with an oversized first issue. And a lot of the publishers, Marvel and DC, have been doing this recently. A lot of first issues have an extra 6 pages or 8 pages, and then they're a dollar more. And I'm on record on this show as describing enjoying oversized and double-sized comics. More content is appreciated, particularly if it's more story pages and not just pinups or sketchbook pages or script pages.
And I did the maths that at $3.99 for 20 pages of stories, that having $4.99 for the number of story pages that we have here, it is actually good value. We're not being ripped off. and additionally, we've got quite a few pages devoted to an additional preview for Cobra Commander in the back of the book.
I think the way to think of it is not that $4.99 for 30 pages is a great deal. It's that $3.99 for 20 pages is a bad deal. And I really want $3.99 for 22 pages. I really want us to go back to that. No one's asking me. No one's listening.
But for anyone worrying that $4.99 is the precedent and we're going to keep on getting $4.99 books, issue number two is back at the, you know, regular old $3.99. So it's just the one-off for the larger first issue. Tim, a question for you. In terms of that bonus content at the back, I know you like to avoid sort of previews and getting spoilers in advance of the issue actually landing. But in terms of having a physical comic in front of you with preview pages in the back of it, does that then pass the Tim Finn taste test of actually you can indulge in a preview?
Yes. When Cobra Commander, when these four pages showed up a month ago in, I forget if it was Transformers or Void Rivals, I did read it. When this Duke preview showed up a month ago in, I forget, Transformers or Void Rivals or both, I did read it. And I sort of giddily laughed as I read it because it's great. But, you know, when it was online some weeks before that, no, I wasn't looking at it. And often, about half the time when I'm in a movie theater, if a trailer pops up for a movie that I know I'm going to see, I'll close my eyes or cover my ears or both, because, you know, trailers are so long and they give away everything, or they give away just enough and I can put it together and I really want, you know, the movie to be a surprise.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
So let's take a look at the covers, and this episode I'm feeling is going to run long, so let's take a brief jaunt through the various covers, Tim.
Cover A is both drawn and colored by Tom Riley, and it's quiet, even though there is an alien robot jet in the background. What's actually most striking about this cover is that we have never seen this logo type before, and except for Snake Eyes, right, or the Dreadnoughts, sort of no, maybe Serpentor on that IDW reprint. We've never had a Duke solo series, so there's never been a Duke logo type. And this is a wide military stencil font, little fuzzy at the edges as if spray painted. Duke is looking at us seriously. He has a scar on his upper cheek and eyebrow, which references the 1964 G.I. Joe and Channing Tatum.
Channing Tatum, and also the classified design sort of continues on that look of Duke having a kind of scar around his eye.
Cover B is drawn by David Aja, who is best known for drawing much of the Matt Fraction Hawkeye. He's an incredible designer. His stuff is very flat and reduced. Interestingly, here, this image is Duke running at us with three guns pointed at him, two explosions behind him, and three planes in the background. Interestingly, the background sky is all white, which is a little unusual for comics. Comics tend not to have white backgrounds. More than two-thirds of this cover is white. It's a good drawing. I don't love it because I think the reference here, this pose to me is very Jack Kirby. And while Jack Kirby is certainly a foundation for much of superhero and action comics of the last 50 years, 70 years, I don't see any relationship between Jack Kirby and G.I. Joe. So this feels like a cool reference, but like slightly an off reference.
Tim, I just sent across an image to you of a front cover that was done by Jack Kirby of Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, which very much is in the sort of the vein of this David Aja illustration.
Yeah. Cover C is drawn by Tyler Boss and colored by Jason Wordy. And we're looking at the side of a building that is either in cross-section or under construction, and we see four different floors with staircases with bunches and bunches of sort of generic gray security officer / Cobra soldiers running up and running down, and Duke has jumped out a window. Everyone in this cover is very small, so it's not the kind of bold cover that A and B are. It's more like a Where's Waldo.
What I like about this cover is that it sort of references to the story inside, where Duke is making his escape from Dr. Burkhart's by jumping through the window. And the other interesting thing is that this is a connecting cover, so it will join up with issues 1 through 5 to make a larger image, with each image echoing what is happening on the interiors.
That's a good clarification that I did not know. Cover D is a gift from Skybound to sometime Talking Joe co-host Jay Cordray. It is a drawing of Duke running at us, and there's an explosion behind him, and it's drawn, and I'll say digitally painted, by Steve Epting, best known for Captain America and Velvet, and definitely an artist who many of us wanted somehow to draw G.I. Joe. Cover E, this is the 1 in 50. The previous two were 1 in 10 and 1 in 25. This is Andrea Sorrentino, who's best known for drawing Gideon Falls at Image. And this is us looking past a very small Duke who we see from behind and mostly shaded out with just a little bit of rubble, brick, and ground. Past him looking up is Starscream, looking menacing as he looks down at us and Duke. There's a lot of color going on here. There's a bright red logo. The sky is both green, but it also grades down to sort of a yellow. There's a lot of magenta in the bottom. You know what this cover reminds me of? This reminds me of Jay Lee's work on the World War II.
If you had paused, I would have said exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it's in the back of my mind, I've always thought Andrea Sorrentino's work looks like Jay Lee's work, but there are also a lot of differences. But this looks like the Dreamwave G.I. Joe Transformers crossover, which took place in World War II, where Jay Lee was drawing the no relation Pat Lee anime-inspired Transformers, and Jay Lee pulled it off, and it was very cool and very strange. And then
F1 to 100 foil incentive by John Boy Myers.
Yeah, this is interesting because John Boy Myers has now, he's one of the few artists who's drawn G.I. Joe for both the current publisher and also the previous publisher. And it really felt like Skybound was not hiring people who had previously worked on G.I. Joe. John Boy Myers drew some of the covers for classic G.I. Joe, the trade paperback collections. And he also did the cover to G.I. Joe Zero, right? The very first comic book that IDW published for G.I. Joe with Duke parachuting.
Yep.
This one is very modern and busy in terms of its color and rendering. It's sort of both comics and animation. It's very Western and also a little Japanese. Duke's got a lot of gear. He's got an M16. He's also, I don't know if they're called that anymore. He's also got a rocket launcher, and there are lots of bits on his arm. He's standing atop Starscream, who's sort of on fire, and there's red-orange flame behind him, and Starscream's got a bunch of bullet holes in him. And if you hold the actual comic book in front of you, it's not as bright and poppy because of the foil treatment. If you're looking at a JPEG on your screen, the cover reads like sort of a normal cover.
My observation on the John Boy Myers is that there's just a little bit of a Whoville look to Duke's face, which I would have preferred not to have been there. But
John Boy Myers, I don't know if he directly takes cues from Todd McFarlane, but when his stuff was showing up in comics 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I remember thinking, this guy feels like a, you know, post Todd McFarlane, sort of the way that he's exaggerating and cartooning artist. Cover G, so A and B and G were open to order. There were no restrictions. You could order as many or as few as you wanted. Cover G is the blank sketch cover. It's printed on a different stock. It's a matte stock that'll take your ink. It's all white except for the corner box and the credits on top of the word Duke, which is printed in black.
Cover H is a 1-to-250 incentive by David Mack, which is quite an exciting cover.
David Mack is best known for his creator-owned book Kabuki and also some issues of Daredevil in the early 2000s. David Mack paints and collages much more than he draws, and many, many of his covers are a single character with a white background. I don't mean a stark white background like cover B or cover G, but I mean, you know, not Batman at night on a gargoyle, or, you know, not the Silver Surfer in space, but a very light background with some, a bit of color or sort of staining. This is the Baroness, who is not in this issue. And sort of her most torso and head and arm and pistol, no Cobra logo on her. Duke's head is behind her, so this is a montage. They're not in the same space. The cover is sort of her, and then he's, his sort of head is floating in the background, looking off to the side. I find Mac's stuff very pretty, but a lot of it I find very similar, and this is still within that range. But I do find this more interesting than many of his covers, because there are two characters here, because it's characters that I like, and because there's a gun, and usually he's like painting Daredevil or Echo, and there's no gun.
And just for comprehensiveness, I'll note some of the other retailer variants that are available. John Giang for Bird City, drawing in that very sort of AI-generated looking style of Duke in lots of military gear. Marco Ferrari, whose cover is via the comic Mint, where he is holding up a dagger, looking a little bit like a Snake Eyes on the loose there, with some interesting reflections in the dagger. There's Santa Fung, whose cover was via Southern Comics Cartel, a Duke in a profile with a sort of ready orange background. Wanted Comics, Rupps, and JJ's and Big Clutch share a variant by Maria Wolf of Duke, looking a little bit wolf-like, coming out of the jungle, surrounded by dense foliage. And the most recently emerging variant is by Nimit Valavia, which can be found on thecomiccupboard.co.uk. That's thecomiccupboard.co.uk. That's available in the UK. And I'm sure they ship internationally, but I think it may be a shared variant with other retailers, but I don't know yet where it is stocked. And this is probably my favorite of the variants. It is Duke in black, silhouetted against a wall where there's a sort of a propaganda style poster of him in the background in that sort of gear that we see from the regular Tom Riley issue number one. It's quite cool. I like that you know, on the run style design to it, which puts you in mind of a similar cover where from the original run where Destro was wanted dead or alive. So that is the lot of the covers. I think we'll probably settle down to a fewer number of covers as we progress to issue two.
As a store owner ordering these, thank goodness.
Shall we get into a plot breakdown?
Yeah.
Okay. A lot happened, so I'm probably going to run over my normal allotted time. We'll see.
Plot breakdown.
Duke, a real American hero, has been traumatized, attacked by a jet that transformed into a giant robot. He witnessed the death of his friend, Frosting. When his superior, Colonel Hawk, demands that he stop asking questions, he flips out and vows that he will find answers. 6 months later, Duke finds his way to Dr. Adele Burkhart, who shares her experience in researching a new clean energy source after she questioned how her work would be used in a high-tech arms race. She points him in the direction of Mars Industries as a culprit. Duke infiltrates Mars and sees a factory floor containing all sorts of futuristic and familiar to us weaponry. He is discovered by Mercer, and after a scuffle, Duke is overwhelmed by security guards and thrown from the premises. The mysterious boss of Mars, whoever could he be, orders that he is not killed to avoid attention. Returning to Dr. Burkhart's place, he finds a massacre at the hands of an unknown Australian. Her dying act is to give Duke a device containing her research. And at that point, some trigger-happy police arrive on the scene and open fire. Duke defenestrates, making his escape. Cut to Hawk. He believes that Duke has become a problem and will bring in the best American heroes to bring him down. Stalker and rock and roll.
So Duke has had his first appearance in the Energon universe in an issue of Transformers. So this is not Energon universe Duke's first appearance. But this is Energon universe Hawk, Cover Girl, Stalker, Rock and Roll, Destro, Mercer, and
Dr. Burkhart.
And Dr. Adele Burkhart's first appearances. And everyone so far seems like they work. No one feels, you know, it's not like Dr. Adele Burkhart is actually like an anthropomorphic dog sidekick, you know, from Mars, or like actually, you know, like a pirate, you know, from Antarctica. It's like, okay, she's a scientist. She's an American.
They're within the parameters of what you would expect that character to be, yes, essentially.
Yes. Yeah. And whereas here, she's looking for, in her backstory, she's researching on a clean energy source and thinks that it comes from space. I sort of thought to myself, you know, I actually don't remember specifically what her job is back in Marvel issue number one, such that I can compare these two to see if the new one is, you know, sort of too far afield or lines up perfectly. And looking at
We mostly just know her for being a troublemaker and
kidnap
and a hostage.
Yes. Edward Mundy's description at yojo.com for Marvel issue number one describes her as a nuclear physicist, considered a traitor by many for her outspoken critique of both the Project Doomsday and the US government.
Very good.
And then in terms of sort of characters matching up, one of the things that I was really aware of, not the last time, but the last really big time that a new G.I. Joe continuity launched in 2008, 2009 at IDW, what people either call the IDW-verse or the Chuck Dixon-verse, the continuity that launched with G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe Origins, and Cobra. I was really aware that those characters, the Chuck Dixon take on G.I. Joe, felt very modern, like 2008, 2007. Nothing about it was retro, and nothing about it was actually even timeless. It was all like 2006, 2007, 2008. And the costumes were so realistic that very quickly I sort of couldn't tell who was who. Like, yes, Snake Eyes looked like Snake Eyes, but a lot of the Joes were just in green with a lot of sort of modern military tech. And I'm so pleased that in, you know, on the cover to Duke number one, and subtly on page one, panel one, and on the big splash for pages two and three, you know, Duke here is referencing costume iterations that we associate with Duke. And similarly, on the final page of this, you know, Stalker looks like Stalker and Rock and Roll looks like Rock and Roll. And whether sort of every detail or some details are alluding to the classified toys or not, I really want to be able to tell these characters apart. And in the scene in this issue one of Duke, where Duke's 6 months later meets Adele Burkhart, Duke has longer hair and he hasn't shaved. And my G.I. Joe iconography brain is starting to think, like, looks like Chuckles, like, looks like Rock and Roll, like, who are the blonde Joes, like, you know, looks like Psych Out, you know. But I totally accept it, because the, you know, the book is called Duke. It's so clearly Duke. Duke is on almost every page of this comic.
You know, from what Joshua Williamson has said as well, is that he wanted to, you know, have those initial introduction pages sort of introduce the Duke, you know, the first shirt sergeant that we know, the guy who sort of is wanting to remain in the field and not sort of take you know, those promotions to be in the, you know, leadership and away from the action, and sort of having a new look to him, but hitting all of those iconic kind of touchstones of what we expect Duke to look like, with the kind of the military fatigue type trousers, the almost canary yellow shirt, and a kind of a bandolier, and the short blonde hair. So let's establish him as the Duke we know before then moving on and I guess breaking him and giving us a slightly different Duke, at least for a little bit, yeah, in this series.
And in terms of introducing the character that we know, the way that Hawk is describing him in the second person, you are this guy, you are this guy, and he's really talking to us, the audience.
Yeah.
You know, Joshua Williamson is referencing the original Duke packaging figure dossier, the card description on the back.
Can you be more specific, Tim?
That Duke declines commissions, that he doesn't want to be an officer. He wants to stay out of it. You know, they tell me that an officer's job is to impel others to take the risks so that the officer survives to take the blame in the event of total catastrophe. With all due respect, sir, if that's what an officer does, I don't want any part of it. Right. And that's written by Larry Hama, and for the packaging in 1982, 1983. And Williamson has said in some interviews or in some blurbs about the comics that he doesn't want to read, hasn't gone back to reread much at all of the Larry Hama run because he wants to make this different. So I think he's consulting the toys, because that's where it all comes from. He's certainly familiar with the cartoon, and like, he read some of the comic then, and I think he's reread a little bit of the comic now, which I take to mean like issue one, you know, or like a couple of issues.
Yeah, I think it sounds like he sort of knows the comic pretty well already, has maybe dipped in here and there, but tried not to go back and revisit too much, just to not, yeah, you know.
What I will say in terms of introducing a character recognizably, back when Transformers 2 came out, all of 2 months ago, I had sort of heard that it was going to be Duke, the known G.I. Joe character who was going to meet a Transformer. And when I turned the page and I saw a jet flying, I thought, oh, it's going to be Ace. Because in G.I. Joe iconography, if you have a guy in a plane and he's got a pilot's helmet with goggles and a gas, an oxygen mask, and he's in a flight suit, that's Ace. And when it turns out to be, you turn the page and it's actually Duke. And I thought, well, okay. I mean, you know.
He's the passenger in the jet, though.
Right. Thank you. And so then when the name of the other guy is revealed and it's not a Joe that I recognize, I thought, well, I want this to be a Joe that I recognize. And I thought, well, he did just die, so I actually don't want it to be a Joe that I recognize. And then on the next page.
First appearance and last appearance.
In Transformers 2, when it's not Ace, it's actually Duke, presses a button and his backpack becomes a jetpack. I thought, okay, well, now there's got to be Hawk, because Hawk, because Hawk version 3 comes with a jetpack. And this looks like an extrapolation of that jetpack. And then I thought, no. This jetpack here is like the 2024 version of the jump. And also, you know, like when the Joes go to the Arctic, they put on white coats and suddenly they all kind of look like Snow Job. And when they go underwater, they put on wetsuits and they all kind of look like Torpedo. So this sort of structure of mine doesn't fully work.
We've sort of deviated a little bit from what we were talking about before.
What were we talking about?
Where were we?
Well, Duke is introduced in the first four pages.
Oh, yes.
And all right, why don't we talk about this, Mark? Since this is still big picture stuff, this issue doesn't have a lot of Transformers action in it.
No. Apart from that flashback, yeah. And I guess it, the Transformers being the mystery that Duke is trying to... So it's like providing the motivation.
So how do you feel as a G.I. Joe fan and not the biggest Transformers fan, and as someone who maybe wants G.I. Joe to not, you know, to sort of be on its own, how do you feel having now read not an issue of Transformers with a Joe in it, but an issue of Joe with a Transformer in it?
Yeah, so I haven't been a great fan of where they've tried to mash up the two universes together. It's been done a few times to more success or less success over the time, but none of the iterations have ever been a 10 out of 10 comic for me, or even very close, and a lot of it leaves me pretty cold. So the approach that they've got here, in terms of the lightness of the approach of it being a driving story force, but pretty centered in the real world and pretty centered on the G.I. Joe characters, works for me so far. It's probably my favorite example of a shared universe, because it is, it is a pretty lightness of touch in terms of, you know, we're not seeing a giant walking robot on every single page in this issue. And that kind of got, you know, is part of my big high level thinking of this issue, is that the team here had an almost impossible challenge of creating a great start to a new G.I. Joe issue one series in that shared universe, because there's so many things that they have to get the balance right on. They have to balance having accessible to new readers, and they seem to have done a good job on that. Over at Comic Book Couples Counseling Podcast, one half of the team there has never read a G.I. Joe comic before, but loved Duke issue one, which is great to hear. So it's got to be accessible to new readers, old readers, old head like us who know G.I. Joe very well. It has to be also positioning itself as doing something different to a real American hero and any other, I guess, iteration of G.I. Joe. It has to stand in this new Energon universe, so to have one sort of foot in a shared universe, but also be a thing unto itself. And then also just, you know, be a cool, compelling, fun story that introduces the right amount of characters to, you know, have us feeling satisfied, but not too many, so it feels overwhelming. So all of these challenges to get that issue number one right, and it feels like they've pulled it off miraculously.
Yeah, well said. It's a really remarkable decision that I would not have thought of, to start this not with a G.I. Joe number one, but with a character number one and a miniseries. It allows this to not carry the weight of expectations of where are all the Joes, or well, I don't want a bunch of alien robots in my G.I. Joe comic. Like, no, we're not there yet. We're not at G.I. Joe yet.
I really like that point, actually. Where are my favorite Joes? Because this is called Duke One, it's not going to be a question of where are my favorite Joes. It's like, there's Duke. You know, that was promised from the name of the comic. And, oh, look, there's Cover Girl. And, oh, look, there's Hawk. There's, oh, look, there's Stalker. Oh, look, there's Rock and Roll. You know, so every Joe that is introduced is like a nice extra little bonus there, rather than, oh, my favorite one's missing. He's not been introduced yet in this group G.I. Joe series.
Yeah.
It's different dynamic to it.
I want to say, from the point of view of I'm just about as big a Transformers fan as I am a G.I. Joe fan, and I don't have a Transformers blog and I don't co-host a Transformers podcast, but
have you spent the last 20 years writing a Transformers book?
No, but for the first 5 years I thought I was writing two books, one on each.
Ah.
Because interviewing a bunch of people worked on both. And so the earliest interviews were very much about both. But you know, like my comics and, you know, art that I own and like the toys that I still have, it's, you know, it's equal parts.
Mm.
So I will say, as a big, longtime Transformers fan, I've been thrilled by the Daniel Warren Johnson Transformers series. And I also really like this issue of Duke and how it mixes and balances. As a top-down statement, I want to say that this is a very good comic book. This is a very good G.I. Joe comic book. And this is a very good first issue of a comic book. Writing, art, color, lettering. I just want to point out on page 5, which is the first page that we haven't seen from the previews, in the final panel, there's a diagonal word balloon, which is something that almost never happens in comics these days, because letterers are lettering in Photoshop or I guess the software, the program Procreate, and things being straight left and right as a default. And back when lettering was done by hand on the boards, you know, you might just sort of inherently as letterer think like, oh, I should make this a little more italicized. I should make this a little diagonal to sort of fit in here because someone's freaking out. And here's Duke freaking out. And this is not breaking a rule, but this is something that you almost never see in the last 30 years of comics that are lettered by a person with a computer. And then it happens again.
This is where Duke is shouting, you weren't there,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So there are four things that are happening to emphasize it, right? One, the letters are on bold. Two, they're not black, they're maroon. Three, it's a burst, it's not an oval. And four, unusually, it's tipped. It's the whole word balloon is at an angle.
And also reinforced by the art of him shouting and the effects of that sort of
yellow burst of color. Yeah, in the inking, there's a white burst behind him, which Jordi Belair colors a little bit light yellow. And that's not something that's actually in the room. That's not like a light. It's not a banner. That's just an effect, like when, you know, someone realizes someone's behind them and you put three little lines by their eye. What's also great about this comic as an issue is that there are many different kinds of scenes. And this is both in writing and in art, and actually for color. There is backstory, first four pages, where Hawk is telling Duke and us who Duke is. Then you turn to page 6-7, the big splash, and you get this big, modern, flashy, double page spread. You know, and this is what comics weren't really doing 30 years ago, and they do a lot of now. You know, like, this art is definitely so Tom Riley can sell this double page spread for like $3,000. And, you know, we see Starscream, but also he's slightly obscured because he's backlit. And also the story sort of for Duke's point of view requires him to be somewhat obscured and mysterious. We see Duke, you know, he's not like bunched up in his cockpit seat. He's not obstructed by the parachute. Like, we see everything here. Like, this is a page which acts a lot like a cover. But then on the next page, right? So I'm segueing into lauding Tom Riley's drawing. And it's not just drawing, it's his design. On the next page, there are 4, 5, 6, 7 panels, and there's just a lot of really smart, well-done decision-making here. So in the first panel, and I know that this is reinterpreted from a Daniel Warren Johnson scene in Transformers, and Johnson is an amazing artist and designer. So Riley here in the first panel does this really cool thing where Frosty as negative space in front of Starscream is continuing from the sort of smoke blast of his ejection seat, and then also the space between Starscream's legs. And then in the next panel, in a reflection on in Duke's visor, we see what he's seeing, and we see that splat is backwards, right? Like,
because it's a reflection.
Like, there are like three things happening in this panel which are great. It's not just that Duke is slightly at a diagonal, it's that his head is tipped back a little bit, we're slightly lower than him. It's that what is happening in a reflection. You know, like, how many times have we seen this in a comic or in G.I. Joe animation? Well, in the second miniseries or the first miniseries, we see Destro walking away from Cobra Commander as a reflection in his helmet in the animated movie. When Cobra Commander sees Pythona sneak by but doesn't stop her, we see a reflection in Cobra Commander's battle helmet of Pythona. You know, here or there, maybe we've seen something reflected in Sergeant Slaughter's glasses. But this is just a neat, small, this isn't like brilliant, it's just like smart, a small, smart visual device.
And I'll note as well that the splat effect, including the design of the letters used, is almost exact replica of how it appears in Transformers issue 2. Mm. So it is very much seeing that splat as a reflection, you know, as appeared in Transformers issue 2. It's a great little attention to detail.
So then two panels later, when the jetpack sort of expands, Starscream is still silhouetted. So this scene is still very much told from Duke's point of view, where Duke can't really tell what he's looking at. It's like a giant humanoid thing, but it's not like some regular cover from an IDW Transformers comic 5 years ago where it's just Starscream. Like, a lot of him is blacked out. And then, two panels later, again, you have this reverse angle where we're seeing what happens as a reflection in Duke's visor. Duke is firing his, I forget what it is, flare gun, laser blaster, palm. But also, it's hitting Starscream in the face in the reflection. And then on the next page, right, so you have this action page, right? So Tom Riley can do it all. You have this double page splash, pages 2 and 3 of Duke saving the kid and shooting some bad guys from the preview. And you think, awesome, G.I. Joe, Duke, awesome. And then you have this two page spread of Duke and Starscream. And you think, awesome, it's Transformer. It's that guy that I know. And there's all this like military stuff with the gear and the cockpit seat. And then you turn the page and there's this page of a lot of choreography and action. And then on the next page, it's all shadows through blinds, through window blinds. And that's easy to do badly and hard to do well. Like, you have to understand anatomy and perspective and what light is doing to either do it well or fake it well. And none of these lines, none of these like sets of parallel lines on Duke, on Hawk, on the wall, on the floor, on the chair, none of them are distracting. None of them are sort of like a rush job, like Tom Riley, like, you know, I drew some of them, you get it. None of them are him not doing his job and then colorist Jordi Belair trying to like make up for it. This is I think my favorite page in the comic, and it's all done with two colors, with the lightest, subtlest of differences between a desaturated beige and a slightly warmer desaturated beige that's got a little like yellow orange in it. And yet you can completely tell who's who and what's what and where's where. This page is, and in terms of, one more sentence, Mark, in terms of compositional balance, like look at the cropping in the first panel, right? Where we're so close on Duke and the way that his head is chopped off at the top of the panel. But then the camera pulls back, but then we're looking up at Hawk. But then we've got this low shot past Duke's hand on the chair. And then there's the freakout panel where he swings. And then the final panel, I'm skipping ahead one, is a vignette panel where like he's out of the panels and now there's just this negative space behind him. Good drawing. You talk now, but I'm gonna get back to this word in a minute. Design.
And also amazing coloring. And this is, I guess, where an art team, you know, comes rather than just, you know, focusing in on the penciler and person doing the inverted commas drawing, because you look at these panels across the sequence with Duke and Hawk, and a lot of what is going on in terms of all of that detail of the shading and the light coming through those blinds, a lot of that is done in color, in the color work. And I'm assuming that that is all on Jordi Belair doing that of you know, working pretty much off her own back, figuring out how that light is working and how best to reflect it in the color. And this is where the colorist really comes into their own as a key member of the art team, elevating a good book to a great book.
All right, so let me come back to design. So 2 years ago, I read this Morbius one-shot that Marvel published, and Tom Riley drew it, and I didn't really know who he was, and I didn't realize he was brand new to comics. And he's done a couple miniseries since then. He did a Thing miniseries for Marvel, written by Walter Mosley, which was beautiful, and the story did not make sense. I'm sorry, Walter Mosley. I really wanted to like your Thing miniseries. Art was amazing. And then with Al Ewing, Tom Riley drew an Ant-Man miniseries. And each issue was a different decade, and he did subtle changes to his art to reflect that. So the issue that takes place in the 60s, Marvel 60s, is a little more retro. And then the issue that takes place in the future with the future Ant-Man, the final issue, Riley drops out all the black outlines on the outsides of his characters. And Tom Riley is drawing...
That was followed up by the Wasp as well.
Which he did not draw.
Oh, okay.
But he did the
covers. He just did the covers.
Yes. And because I think he was on to the Superman Night Terrors. And Tom Riley draws in a style that currently is very well occupied by Chris Somney, who's done incredible work on Black Widow and Thor, the Mighty Avenger, and most recently Firepower with Robert Kirkman. And then another artist, Evan Doc Shaner, who most recently drew a Shazam miniseries when that second movie came out. And then also an artist, Leonardo Romero, who did some Kate Bishop Hawkeye, is currently doing some Marvel Masterworks covers and drawing for DC Birds of Prey. Tom Riley perfectly fits in this pie that I'll cut into four slices right now with these other three artists. And what they're all doing is they are drawing less with lines, less like a Jim Lee or a Jason Fabok, and more with shapes, like Alex Toth. All these people are looking back to Alex Toth. And Toth is not as much of a household name in comics the way that Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko or Marshall Rogers or Neil Adams are from the 50s, 60s, 70s, because Toth doesn't have one or two sort of longer runs identified with a specific character. Toth bounced around a lot, right? And he did like two Green Lantern stories, and he did like one or two or three stories for EC Comics in the 50s, right? And he worked in animation, designed Space Ghost, storyboarded for Super Friends. And, you know, it's like, what's the most famous thing that Toth did for Batman? It's like, oh, well, he did that one cover for the first Batman black and white miniseries, right?
Great cover, though.
Yes, incredible cover. That should be the cover of the reprint, not the Jim Lee cover, which is so antithetical to the concept of Batman black and white. Anyway, so Toth was very much thinking about light and shadow and shape, and Toth designed everything he drew. When he went to draw it, his brain was dividing it into geometric shapes, where the light is hitting, where the shadows are hitting, what the positive space, the negative space, where the characters are, the background, what's the dominant part of the character, like this shoulder, this arm, what's the secondary part of the character. And what Toth and these other artists who look to him do is they don't fuss with detail. And like, sure, the page in Duke Number One, 6 months later, looking past the U.S. Capitol over D.C., yes, that's a detailed panel. But look down at the bottom of the page, the panel where Duke in his Jeep pulls up to this townhouse, right? The amount of detail that Tom Riley is putting into this, it's much more about shape. I'm aware of like the plane of the front of this building and that triangle of shadow and then the bay window. I'm aware of the rectangles of the windows as if you cut them out of little pieces of paper, as if you cut them out of like little pieces of cardboard, not as like, think of, you know, like a Brian Hitch Marvel spread, not as like wonderful noodly detail. And when Riley draws Dr. Burkhart for the first time on the next page, how does he make her older than the sort of uber like 20, 30 year old that like every Joe and Bruce Wayne is in comics? You know, like Peter Parker's a little younger depending on the story, but like everyone, all these characters in comics are like between 22 and 33, you know? Riley does it with four lines, one under each eye, and then one at each cheek. It's like, okay, Dr. Burkhart's in her 50s, maybe her 60s. And look at her shirt in that panel. Two lines. And here's another artist who did this kind of thing, Mike Parabek, who drew Batman Adventures in the 90s, the book that was based on the animated series. These are all artists who you might think like, oh, well, that's a, quote, animated style. And there is a lot in common, but it doesn't come from animation. Animation and it are coming from the same place, which is reduction. And if you want more examples of this, go to Tom Riley's Instagram, which is Tom Riley Art, and just look at all these character shots that he has. Like, you'll get overwhelmed, pleasantly so, because there's all this great color and he's drawing in so many different styles. He's like cartooning more, he's cartooning less. But look at this series of all the different like Spider-Man costumes and Spider-Man iterations that he's doing, where it's always the same background and it's a different Spider-Man. It's like Spider-Man in a black and white costume, and Spider-Man 2099 and Miles Morales. And not only do some of them have like a different sense of shadow, but all of them look like, it's almost like some of them, he drew them with Sharpie. It's like, how can I do this with as little detail as possible but that totally embeds them in the space? And then also, I'll say one last thing about Tom Riley's amazing art and design, because it's not just drawing. It's his poses. On his Instagram page, he has all these Spider-Man drawings from the last 2 years. And every Spider-Man pose, like, all these different versions of Spider-Man who are swinging from left to right, they all have different poses. And you start to think, oh, yeah, that is sort of more of the like Spider-Man 2099 pose. Oh, yeah, that's sort of more of a Miles Morales pose. I am so thrilled. I can't tell you, when I read that Thing miniseries, when I saw that Wasp miniseries a year and a half, 2 years back, in the back of my mind, I thought, man, could Tom Riley ever draw G.I. Joe? But it was sort of like, well, maybe he would do a variant cover for IDW. It's like, that's sort of the most, it's like, well, maybe he would do an out of continuity backup story, the way that there's that, like, remember the 2019 annual, and there's a backup story that like takes place in the animated movie. Anyway,
this feels like a good place, maybe, to, while we're talking about Tom Riley's art, to insert my little Tom Riley anecdote, which is that if you do a Google search, type in 95 Tom Riley G.I. Joe, and what will probably come up will be a Tom Riley cover recreation on comicartfans.com of the cover to G.I. Joe 95, which, ironically enough, was drawn originally by Andy Kubert, who's now back drawing the G.I. Joe covers on Unreal American Hero. And this was a commission that my brother requested from Tom Riley. We were doing a series of commissions from artists, asking them to sort of recreate or reinterpret a G.I. Joe cover, often artist's choice. And we both discovered Tom Riley sort of from his social media posts, sort of just seeing that art and seeing the style and how exciting it was. So he reached out to him to get him to draw a cover, you know, cover quality commission recreation. This was back in 2019, so distant past, you know, just when he was starting out. And very cool. Up to the point that he drew Duke issue one, I think this was the first and only G.I. Joe thing that he had drawn. So I think me and my brother there sort of, you know, prophesizing what might follow.
This is interesting, this cover recreation, because it looks very much like Andy Kubert, with the sort of feathering and the way that he details things, and it does not have the sort of flatter, more graphical, more geometric shape thinking of Tom Riley's work from the last couple of years. It's very cool.
It's much lesser deviation than the original cover than most of the other covers the other commissions in this series.
I just want to say one last thing as I'm lauding Tom Riley's sort of lack of fussiness and noodling. I never feel, when reading a comic by one of those four artists, Shaner, Somni, Romero, or now Riley, I never feel like I'm being cheated. Like, oh, they didn't put in as much detail. They're not, quote, trying as hard. Or, oh, this looks rushed. The opposite. This just looks incredibly skilled and considered. And, you know, when you look at, there's the spread where Duke does see all the Cobra vehicles. And he says, what are they? And then on the right side of that page, he sees sort of the close-up of the, what's the battle armor? The snake?
The snake armor.
Like, no, absolutely. Like, Riley can draw all that stuff. He can draw all the bits. It's that he's choosing not to. Should we talk about color for a minute?
Okay.
All right. So Jordi Belair often uses a limited palette, right? She's not coloring in the, I don't mean just on Duke. I mean, when Jordi Belair colors books, she's often using just two or three dominant colors in a scene, and sometimes only two or three colors in a scene. If you want a really cool example of this, look at the Kelly Thompson Black Widow series that Marvel ran about 2 years ago. It lasted what is now three skinny collections. There are many, many scenes where it's like the only color is red, or the only color is red and this other red. And that happens here. Sometimes it's for effect. So this page where Duke he's sneaking in under the building and he's got a black cap and he's all in black. And he's in the sewer and he sneaks around a corner, and two of the panels are all just sort of greenish. And there's one panel where he's going, is it up or down? I think up the elevator shaft. Anyway, there's some red there. And then there's a couple panels that finish out the page with this very, very, very light gray green. So when I want to point out two things, and it is Mercer. He's not named, but I know it's Mercer because I saw a pinup of some characters. Although this is cute, because if you didn't know who this was, you would assume that the M on his shirt stands for Mars.
Well, I think it does, but it just can stand for
Mercer. For me, it stands for Mercer. All right, so the page where Mercer
showed... Oh, there was there was a character lineup.
Yeah, the four.
Which was revealed, I think, at San Diego, but I think it was also issued as a poster to retailers.
Oh, okay.
Don't know if you got sent one of those, Tim?
I did not. Well, I want to say I did not. We get so many Marvel posters, junk mail. Those are different categories. The Marvel posters are great. The junk mail's not. They sometimes get in a pile at the register with some invoices, and sometimes I see posters a little after we've gotten them. But I don't think we got that. Okay, Mercer shows up here, and not because she ran out of time, but for effect, to change your focus when that second panel, when Duke swings his arm around to knock Mercer's arm off him, Belair drops out the color in the background. And then in the third panel of this page, when Duke headbutts Mercer, he knocks the color off of Mercer. And the color on him it's not a proper fill. It doesn't sort of, quote, stay within the lines because he's a blur. So it's acting a little bit like the inking is, the speed lines on him. But it's also the color on him is just becoming this other sort of very small mess. And, you know, I was really struck by there was a panel or two in issue 301 of G.I. Joe where their background just gets dropped out as white. And I think back when color artists in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and some of the 90s, they were very aware of how crummy the paper was that comics were printed on. And they were very aware that they only had 64 colors, although Jim Shooter tells us it was actually less than that because some would print too dark to work with. And a lot of times, not like every page, every issue, but in general, a lot of times a colorist might choose in the old color and printing techniques to not color something, that the, quote, white of the page could do some of the work. Maybe it's a sky, maybe it's like the shiniest part of something metal. And that's happening here to a great extent. It's like not technically a pure white on that second panel, but I like Belair giving herself limitations. And then the other example, the scene when Duke escapes Mars headquarters and he's walking back across the street and he gets up to the staircase outside to this townhouse. And he's going back to that meeting. And the fourth panel on that page, when he says ... get this message, and we're looking out past the broken door outside to where he is down on the sidewalk. Everything around him is this slightly textured desaturated gray-green. And then everything inside is this dull red. And Jordi Belair there is coloring as story. There is no red light that's on. There's no red light source, right? She's choosing red because she's editorializing. She's saying, oh no, something's gone wrong. And then the next panel is just entirely that red. And then you turn the page, and I'm not counting the one cell phone. And I'm also not counting the one panel where you can slightly see outside of the windows. But the entire next two pages, it's only red and only slightly darker, more gray red. And some of this is to diminish the horror. Because if you colored all these people who've been shot up with sort of normal, like the blue shirts and their yellow shirts and their brown pants and their blue pants and like the white walls, it would be worse, right? This is a thing that Marie Severin was doing at EC in the 50s in the horror comics and the war comics. Sometimes she would just knock an entire panel out or an element of a panel because it was so ghastly, like a monster or someone dying. But this, you know, and this red, it's not like Jordi Belair didn't invent this. We all kind of know this, you know, from like Red Alert and like submarine movies and horror films, or just the concept of like seeing red. You know, if you get angry and you see red, that's sort of physiological as well as poetic. But what Belair does in this book and what the best colorists do is they separate each scene by mood and by color. So that one scene may be like during the day, and then the next scene might still be during the day and only an hour later, but maybe it's inside and it just has a different color cast. Or maybe in this scene, something's gone wrong. Or maybe in this scene, now someone's sneaking around. Or maybe in this scene, we go from one inside to a different inside. And that first scene was like slightly purple. And the second one is now slightly, whatever, yellow. So some of this is just about visual variety. Some of this is about, of course, clarifying artwork. And then a lot of it is about enhancing what is there, enhancing what's in the story and enhancing what's in the art. And the best colorists aren't just people who are like looking at a frag viper and saying, well, that's brown, and looking at a heat viper and saying, well, that's yellow, except for the part that's purple. They're making decisions, they're adding textures, and they're enhancing.
Yeah. And making, you know, these pages with where it's all red, the contrasting green of the phone, then when she's handing it to him and when it's in his own hand, it pops out that much more because of that high degree of contrast that you can immediately get drawn to that and see that, you know, there's something there.
Yeah.
And it's in, and it's important.
This will actually be one sentence, I promise. The second to last page, the two panels at the bottom on the helicopter when Hawk talks to CoverGirl and it's all in green. I have commented before about how in the IDW run, every time we're underground in the pit, Duke and Psych Out and Mainframe are like smothered in green, and I find it really ugly. But there's a big difference between that and this.
Back to some plot. We've established that Duke is, you know, the man of action. He's had a falling out with Hawk and has gone off. He's gone on, met Burkhart and sort of. She's explained that she thinks she knows what's going on, and it's this Mars industry. Duke breaks in, and then we've got this sort of double page view as he breaks in of the factory floor. And this sort of illustrates a sort of key point for me, which in terms of this book is that I thought from some of the description going into it, I thought this was going to be a really slow burn, that we might see Duke plus maybe one extra G.I. Joe character, maybe two, in this first issue. Thought it would be, you know, very slow to introduce things, but we've got, you know, that raft of named G.I. Joe characters that we talked about earlier. And then as he looks out onto this floor, it's like, holy moly, you know, it's maybe Cobra's not established yet, but Mars is well onto the on the way. And on this page we see the snake armor, so you see the Cobra claws, we see the hiss tanks, and significantly the G.I. Joe classified design of the hiss tank with the extra components to the screen is the most significant component of that. We sort of see the Cobra Fang helicopter, and very subtly as well, I don't know if you spotted this,
Bat twos. But
yeah, there's a kind of a silhouette of a bat. It looks like, you know, it's a kind of done in black and went then with this reverse silhouette, what did you call it, of the bat's panel there as well. So it's
negative space.
Yeah, once you see it, you know, that's unmistakably a bat. So that Cobra tech, even if Cobra doesn't possibly yet exist in this world, you know, very advanced.
I also appreciate the quote regular tanks behind the hiss, because I don't remember what Cobra had in the comics before the hiss, but certainly in the cartoon, you know, they had jets before they had the Rattler. And I've always found it funny and cute, you know, sort of what's the proto Cobra stuff.
They may be regular tanks, but I think what is possibly what they're intended to be is the hiss gun turrets. So you see that hiss on the right that is closest to us. It's missing its turret. So I think that is the turret behind it that is yet to be mounted.
Yes, very good. Very good. And then these fangs are not the original fang. These are those newer fangs from 2 years ago, right? For the 4-inch figures?
Oh, right.
Because the seating and the engine stuff is a little different. Not as good, but still great.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that is the reference that they're trying to use an updated, you know, closer to classified version of things as they're going along. So, you know, let's assume that this is an intentional using the slightly modified, updated version of the Fang. But yeah, it's very, you know, very close to the iconic look.
Let's go back to your point, though, about how much happens in this issue and how quickly it does move. Because I was ready, based on a lot of slow burn comics in the last 20 years, many of which I liked, I was ready for Duke, you know, certainly not someone like Dr. Burkhart to show up in this. But I would have expected 10 pages of Duke, you know, like pinning on a bulletin board things with red thread,
right?
Like his conspiracy board, his beautiful mind, Flash TV show Barry Allen conspiracy board, and like, you know, some of these people who show up just in the background of the conspiracy scene, you know, I sort of thought he might be talking with some of them, and some of them would become characters for an issue or two, but it's not really a character that we know, and they're not going to become a character. They're not going to become a G.I. Joe character. But actually, now that I think about this, this issue motors as fast as the first episode of G.I. Joe, which makes a lot of sense considering how much Williamson says he loves the cartoon. And at the same time, this issue, you know, slightly reminds me of Marvel issue number one, because there is a Dr. Burkhart in it, but also because so much happens. There are several, you know, location changes. I haven't reread G.I. Joe number zero or the Chuck Dixon G.I. Joe number one from IDW, you know, 2008, 2009 recently, but My general sense of that recollection is that, you know, those comics are slower paced.
And interestingly, it's, you know, a lot of it is established in terms of mystery. It's not spelled out to us, you know, what these vehicles are. It's Mercer appears, but he's not named. And Destro appears, but is, again, sort of shown with this air of mystery. And anyone who's reading this book, I think, will pretty much across the board realize that this is Destro, you know, so recognizable, but he's showing sort of in that partial shadow and not named anywhere, like, you know, who is this man of mystery, almost coming to this afresh, similar to kind of how he was originally introduced back in Real American Hero, when he was initially shown in shadow, and it took some time before he was revealed and named.
Do you think the trigger-happy police officers who find Duke with all the dead people in the scene that's colored all red, do you think those are actually police?
It's a good question, Tim. So the design of those police is very much aligned to the look of the Cobra infantry you know, G.I. Joe classified design. So they look like Cobra troopers, bar, you know, bar the riot shields and the police logo across the front of it. So I think, you know, there's a big hint there that somehow these police are potentially linked to maybe Mars or Cobra of the future. And the fact that, yeah, he says he's unarmed, we're on the same side, and they say he's got a gun, and then let loose in a very, very trigger happy way, makes you think that there must be something more nefarious going on, that maybe they might be, you know, legitimate police in some form, but definitely not really acting on the right side of the law. Just while we're talking about Destro as well, I just noticed in that room they've got, it's very atmospheric. This is, you know, fiery thing around, you know, what I think is meant to be like a decorative pond or something in his room. But then you've got this Iron Maiden torture device and swords and a whip and a medieval kind of club thing. And then you've also got a stuffed leopard in the corner of the room. And I wonder if that's meant to be an Easter egg reference to Pimp Daddy Destro there with his leopard print.
Well, I don't love Prophet's director, Destro. I feel like the mythology of that has gotten overblown, and it doesn't really work for me as an expression of the character. So I hope not, but it does.
It might be just left there as a little nod, a subtle nod.
It does feel like, you know, a trophy. You know, Destro hasn't been established to us as any kind of big game hunter, but maybe his dad was.
Mm-hmm. Certainly the, you know, the aristocracy of Britain would have collected, you know, stuffed animals over, you know, across the generations, and then being handed down. So what was that? So the next thing that you were going to move on to after the police?
I'll do that one later. Since I said a nice thing about Russ Wooten's lettering, I want to say a couple more nice things about Russ Wooten's lettering. I think I read this in the commentary pages in Firepower, which Robert Kirkman, every issue, Robert Kirkman would call Chris Somney on the phone and they'd talk, and then the phone conversation would get transcribed and become three pages of text in every issue of Firepower, where they just muse about the issue that you've just read, which they had written and drawn months earlier. And it's fluffy but fun. And I think it's there that Kirkman says, Russ Wooten's a really good letterer and designer. And that's part of me a year ago realizing this thing that I've said a couple times on the show now in anticipation of the Energon universe, that every book that Skybound publishes looks great, art, color, lettering, design. So these two pages where these trigger-happy police officers show up and fire at Duke, you know, I think there is this sort of default feeling that people might have about lettering in comic books, that A, it's easy, or B, maybe not easy, but sort of anyone could do it if they had a computer and the right software. And that's really not true, because lettering in comics is design, right? And like placement of word balloons, that's only part of it. It's type and typography, it's shapes, and the fact that you can type out letters rather than do them by hand, it's like no, this is still a real job that you need training for. Look at the great work that Wooten does by putting all these blams both in the foreground at the bottom of that left page. He's got a gun, bang, 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 bang. And also in the background, but overlapping and then cropped, blam, 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 blam. And then it continues on to the next page, but it adds so much of this sense of noise, of cacophony, of rushing, moving fast, of panic. And then in that second panel, when we have the close-up on Duke and he's gritting his teeth and looking back, sort of it even continues there. And then on the next panel, there's a little bit of a break where there's some space given over to the stairs that he just ran up and some bullets hitting those. But then also bang, 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 bang in the foreground, and then ch-ch-ch up in the distance. It's just great. Like it's not just, oh, Russ Wooten picked a good font and then typed it. It's much more than that.
Indeed. So in terms of the story, I think we've got to the point where Duke has made his escape through exit via window and on his way to follow up his mission before we cut to Hawk, who is talking to an unnamed person on the phone, being updated about Duke.
Is it the president?
Could be.
I don't know.
It could be. Well, he said, so it's someone senior to Colonel Hawk here. He calls him sir, and it sounds like, I don't know, what has been described to him is that Duke has gone rogue. So obviously, you know, the murder of those people in Dr. Burkhart's house has been pinned on him. So I was going to ask Tim, what do you think of this version of Colonel Hawk? He's designed differently. He's an older guy with this grey at his temples, looking a little bit, little bit Hal Jordan there. And, he's being established as the guy to hunt Duke and also the higher up who's telling him to stand down. But I don't think that necessarily paints him as a villain here. It's just the superior officer who's, got his orders and, possibly or probably knows more than Duke does at this point.
I like the look. There's long been a visual confusion between Duke and Hawk because from the very beginning, they both had blonde hair and relatively similar costumes. And they were both the leader. And, the 86 Hawk figure tries to correct that with brown hair. And then the cartoon sort of follows that up, although technically sort of has black hair in the cartoon. But by then Duke was sort of out of the cartoon, and Hawk had, except for some commercials, never been in the animation. In the comics, it was always a little hard when they showed up together because they both had blonde hair, and the limits of comic book coloring in the 80s were such that Duke with blonde hair and his blonde or mustard shirt, and Hawk with his blonde hair and his like brown jacket or like green shirt under his brown jacket, or maybe Duke's shirt was miscolored light green. In the comic, I didn't see a lot of differentiation between the two characters. And so when the comic, wasn't it a couple years ago during the IDW run, just decided that Hawk actually had brown hair, that had my seal of approval. So as a visual, I think the hair thing is great. I think putting him in an officer's uniform from the get-go is cool. That poster pinup that you referred to, Four Joes and Four Cobras, that was released at San Diego. Part of why I was so excited about those was that each of the characters, and this is again a Tom Riley thing, so clearly had A, different body types, and B, different poses, even though they're just standing there. And then, yes, I love the idea that he's got to hunt Duke reluctantly because I don't want Hawk to be a bad guy.
Indeed, and here we're introduced as well to Krieger, which is of course Courtney Krieger, aka Cover Girl, looking possibly like similar to a design that we might recognize. And yeah, interestingly, we've got one panel of her, so how can we draw too much? But it did make me think of the G.I. Joe film, A G.I. Joe Rose of Cobra, where Cover Girl was, there is almost like General Hawk's right hand person, the sounding board person that was kind of just, literally sort of standing a foot behind him in a good few scenes.
Yeah, but since this has happened both times, like after that first movie, I thought, is Cover Girl's secondary military specialty something like data specialist or secretary? Because in that movie, she just walks up to Hawk's office and hands him a thing, right? Mm. But her secondary military specialty is AFV mechanics. Uh-huh. And I think that's armored forward vehicle, but I'm not sure. And she comes with the Wolverine, and her primary military specialty is armor, which is to say tank. I don't think she's in any sort of assistant or secretary or attaché. Why don't I use a better word? I don't think she's in any attaché role here. If this was Stalker or Rock and Roll right here, I wouldn't think oh, well, they've been demoted. They just have to get ferried along with Hawk, and he can talk to them so he's not talking to himself. I appreciate this small way in which another Joe is in this issue, right? She's in one panel. And I thought, yes, it's another character that I know. Yes, it's a character that people like. You know, it's not like... And she's in something that is recognizably her costume. She's not in, like, some generic jumpsuit, or she's not in civilian clothes. You know, it's like, no, hand me the version that I, you know, that I appreciate. So.
And then we turn the page and we get two more G.I. Joes introduced. We get American Heroes in an interesting font there. Stalker, Rock and Roll. So very much in their classified designs, and on Rock and Roll, you can even see hints of his tattoos on his arms. I did actually have a sort of error detected question mark here on Rock and Roll. It looks a little bit like he's been colored as being topless to me.
There is a very, if you look at the where the ammo belts cross at his chest,
yep,
and you go up, I think he's wearing a tank top. So there's a little bit of a curvy line under his chin, above where the ammo belts cross,
mm-hmm,
under his collarbone. And there is the subtlest difference between what I will call the shirt color and just above it, the flesh color. The shirt color actually matches his beard and eyebrow color, but it's really subtle.
Yeah, I think they're trying to follow the classified design, and that has him wearing a kind of t-shirt type looking, I sort of think, modern military design, where it's a kind of whitey beige mostly, but then with the kind of the upper torso and top of the arms, a sort of a darker, you know, olive drab type green. And it's probably that colouring that is the thing that is missing and makes it look like it's, you know, his, the top of his fingers through to the top of his head are all the same colour. But I'll class this one as a very light error detected, but it's hardly the most egregious thing in the world.
Okay, I feel like the dialogue that goes from the final page, the second to last page, to the final page, I feel like this is one of those cases where it would work better in a movie or TV show, mm-hmm, where you can have the actor emphasize it. And I feel like in print, I would have picked slightly different words for the final page. Not if we bring in the best to hunt him down. If you want to track an American hero, we get American Heroes. It's like, I feel like it's, the rhythm of that is off for me. I feel like it needs two more words, and I'm not fishing for a real American hero. That's not what I'm doing here. I feel like it's like, if we want to track an American hero, we need a team of American heroes. Mm. You know, it's like, if we want to track, I don't know how to phrase this. I feel like the setup, and then you turn the page, and then the payoff are slightly out of balance. And the rhythm of this sentence needs two more words. Because he's like, I certainly understand what's happening. You know, like, it's a comic book. We turn the page. We get this sort of half splash, like, awesome shot of a favorite character. Awesome shot of a favorite character. So we, the readers, can go, yes, those guys I like, they're going to be in the story, right? And so Chris Somney can sell a page that's kind of like a cover. And and I understand that Hawk is actually saying this to CoverGirl. He's saying, if we want to track an American hero, we have to get Stalker. But, you know, I feel like it would be, okay, get me Stalker and Rock and Roll. Like, that's what you'd actually say. But I feel like, because it's a comic book and there aren't supposed to be a lot of word balloons or sort of narration boxes on this final page, I feel like Williamson took a few words out of this last bit of dialogue, and it, anyway, enough of that. it's still a cool ending. And I mean, I think I even knew that Stalker was on the cover to issue 2 or something. But I'm sort of not looking very carefully. And
shall we do some I Spies?
Yeah.
I spy with my little eye.
So I've got a handful. I'll go first. Yeah. When Hawk is first talking to Duke, he says, "Frankly, I expected this of your brother, but never you." Implication being perhaps talking about his half-brother Falcon, as kind of established in G.I. Joe, the movie.
Yeah, that is a Buzz Dixon invention. That's not a Larry Hama invention.
Next up, in the pile of books on Duke's seat, there's a book called UFO, and underneath is a picture of a brain on a book with the title Mindbender.
I bet that's written by a crazy dentist.
On the walls of Dr. Burkhart's study, there's a little Transformers Ark spaceship.
Oh, yeah. And then a Stark repulsor. What is it?
Arc reactor.
An arc reactor.
I think we've seen the Ark spaceship in the pages of Transformers. That's the crash thing that they're in, isn't it? But it's also on the front cover to Cobra Commander issue 1 in the background. And more in your face and on the nose are blueprints to the Mass Device.
Yeah.
From obviously I guess that's the first G.I. Joe miniseries cartoon, where it's the key plot point. Also in Dr. Burkhart's house, in that house party type conspiracy theorist gathering, on the wall is a poster that says, "I want to believe." And actually, looking at this again, the image appears to be
the Ark.
Most likely the Ark. Yeah, as the spaceship instead of the...
It's not the X-Files UFO.
And yeah, a bit of synchronicity about this is that we know I Want to Believe as being the X-Files famous poster, I Want to Believe. But there was also Super 7 released a Mothership version of that poster as well, I Want to Believe, with a picture of the big Cobra Mothership that was sort of trailing their crowdsourced crowdfunder. And that poster was at San Diego Comic-Con in the summer of 2023, which was when this issue was being drawn. So it's entirely possible that they also had that in the back of their minds as this was being created. And then we've talked about a lot of the other ones as we've gone along. The final one I had was they talked about, Dr. Burkhart talked about being attacked by an Australian, which I wondered whether that was a potential hint at Major Blood. Might.
Yeah. My I Spy was page 11, panel 1, which you have referred to with the UFO poster at Burkhart's townhouse. The little bits of, there are 4 bits of dialogue there. And the second one says, "It's a secret society in the ice, man," which someone at the party is saying. And there's no arrow pointing to who, because it's just the background noise. And I don't think this is very specifically this, but I did think, oh, well, in the first live-action Transformers movie, isn't Megatron rescued from the ice? Like he in decades past, he crash landed on Earth in the Arctic or Antarctic, and this government agency has been keeping him frozen ever since. Or in the 1987 animated G.I. Joe movie, Cobra Law is a 40,000-year-old society in the Himalayas, which you could also describe as a secret society in the ice, man. And then the fourth one. On this panel, and then he ripped off. Then he ripped his face off, and was another dude underneath. Is that a reference to V, the TV miniseries from the 80s?
Possibly, or possibly Zartan, just the way that he is in often in the cartoons, wearing a mask and rips off his mask face, and there's Zartan's face underneath. And then the next dialogue balloon says, "They got little green men piloting them inside their heads. I know it." Which I guess could be a reference to headmasters from Transformers.
These are also general enough and
non-specific.
And then this one is, again, this is on page 20. After all these other guards show up and then Mercer punches Duke really hard in the stomach. There's this final wordless panel of a bunch of guards sort of surrounding and piling on top of Duke. And this reminds me of the first and the second G.I. Joe animated miniseries, because in both, Duke is captured by Cobra after being surrounded by Cobra soldiers. And in certainly the first one, I think it's the second episode. Also, I think in the second miniseries, a Cobra soldier like knocks him out. And I don't think Williamson is necessarily making a reference here, but you know, things can slightly parallel. You know, if you have 100 monkeys in a room with typewriters, eventually two of them are going to write stories where, you know, different versions of Duke get surrounded by Cobra soldiers and get captured, knocked out, or tossed out.
I think as well, I've heard Josh Williamson describe this scene that he said in his original script, like some security guards come and take Duke away or something like that. And then Tom Riley just went wild on the art and just overloaded him with as many as he could possibly draw, just to make it as exciting as it could be. Oh, I had one more Easter egg that I forgot about, which was the Mars logo, which is quite cool. It's like the letters M-A-R-S with then this sort of line coming through it, like it's like the an ellipse of the representing kind of the planet Mars, you know, with some backlight behind it, creating that arc. And apparently, my inside track here is that that was a sort of Hasbro design for the Mars logo, sort of commissioned for the classified line, that Lenny from the team came up with some ideas, and they sent it out to a company called Volta, who did the final polished versions of the full Mars logo, which I don't know are actually seen anywhere in the classified line, but have made their way onto Etsy as a Mars design and seen as a single M on figures and so on. So yeah, either using the classified design for Mars logo, or one of them, because there are multiple, or coming up with a very similar idea potentially, or just using some online research and finding something that fits that can then be tweaked.
I wanted to, this isn't an Easter egg, it's something we didn't talk about, but I feel like we should. This really fun statue in the Mars headquarters of...
A bit like a cross between Destro and the Oscar statue.
Yeah, and I think it's also sort of supposed to be Mars, the Roman god of war, because he has a shield and... Is there also a sword?
Looks like there? Just a shield.
Okay.
And a glowing red eye security camera.
No, there's a sword behind the shield. The page with the exterior of the building before Duke sneaks in.
Yes. Yeah.
It sort of looks like the Silver Surfer with a shield and a sword. And this is a fun bit of writing and design because it's a way to show, finger quotes, Destro without showing Destro. Because this face, this shiny, bald face, head.
Yeah, chrome face. Yeah.
Is how you would draw Destro. But when you see him on the next page, his face is in shadow. And the sword and the shield, you know, speak to what the company does, and to the extent that there has never been not only a logo type but any kind of symbol or mascot for you know, Mars, you know, this is neat. And you know, you see like security companies and cybersecurity companies, you see their advertising online or like billboards, and it's oftentimes like a shield or, you know, like a hand or a fist or something, that some graphical symbol that denotes strength and security. So here we have the Silver Surfer with a sword and a shield and no board. It's lacking the power cosmic.
There's also in researching the logo, I came across the company Mars, M-A-R-S, which uses a very, very similar logo with that kind of that arc cutting through it. And the in this case, the Mars stood for Manvers Automotive Repair Specialist. So it's a body workshop somewhere.
Error detected. There's a typo in Joshua Williamson's editorial at the back. The final two lines of the first column, he writes, "Together we're building a new origin, the G.I. Joe team, and taking a character," and it's missing the word "for." "Together we're building a new origin for the G.I. Joe team." Joshua Williamson and editorial team, I forgive you. I was slightly disappointed to see the Cobra Commander preview, because I've now seen it in two other comics. But I also realized that many people are only reading Duke Number One. They haven't read Transformers or Void Rivals, and this is the place to hook them. And also, maybe after they read Duke Number One and this Cobra Commander preview, they're more inclined to go back to their store and pick up Void Rivals and or Transformers. So, you know, just because I've seen this before doesn't mean other people have.
Quote of the week, quote of the week. Quote of the week, quote of the week.
Quote of the week, quote of the week.
Quote of the week.
Do you have a favorite line of dialogue, Tim?
Yeah. When the guards are dragging Duke out of Mars, it's the second panel on a page. Mercer's behind him, and the whole background has been knocked out in red, and Duke screams, "I knew it!" That's a cathartic moment where, A, he's wrong. Mars didn't build Starscream. Mm-hmm. But in terms of Duke's quest and him being upset about his friend and, you know, people saying he's crazy or Hawk not listening to him, you know, when you get to this point in the story, you're like, yes, yes, he knows he's not crazy.
Mm. I had a couple. I really liked the line, "You're turning into a walking American nightmare," that Hawk uses to describe Duke, which obviously brings into our mind all of the, you know, real American hero type imagery. Apparently he lingered over that one quite a long time about how best to describe Duke, and some of the runners up were soup sandwich, which is, you know, a real term, and Section 8, which is all about sort of getting booted out of the army for sort of mental health issues, which apparently is no longer the right terminology for that. I also liked Dr. Burkhart's line where she talks about, she says, "I believe this is the new apple from the tree of knowledge, and there is a snake hoping someone takes a bite out of it." So that little early allusion to a snake in this book.
I appreciate those two, Walking American Nightmare, snake, back on page 2. You know, from day one, it's been clear that you're thinking he's going to say a real American hero, and he says a man of action, right? Which is a different term. We're excited by these references. The first time someone calls it G.I. Joe, we'll get excited. And so far in Duke Number One, Williamson doesn't overdo it, which I really appreciate. And here's an example of someone overdoing it. In the live action film, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, all the Joes are figuring out what they're going to do for Act 3 at the pit, and Ripcord or Hawk says, "Now I know," and then the other one says, "And knowing is half the battle."
Mm-hmm.
It's like, no, don't do that. Don't do that.
So let's go into Yo Joeage. I think we've talked the heck out of this thing.
8. We're giving it an 8.
8. That's about as high as you ever got.
It might be a 9. 9? 9.
Wow. I'm going 9 as well. I loved it. I'm giving 1 point to Spare because I think it might get better. I think there might be more that we get. You know, script great, art great, colouring great, letters great, design around it great, covers are great. And, you know, I set this up in my mind as an impossible challenge. That first issue of G.I. Joe, getting that balance right, particularly in a shared universe with Transformers, how do you make everyone happy with it? And somehow they've done it. And the, you know, the reviews across the board that, you know, people have been sharing, you know, on the various review websites and so on, you know, it's pretty consistent 10 out of 10, 5 out of 5, lots of praise, lots of plaudits. This is a well-received comic.
Maybe that one point, the missing point for me, I like the cover a lot. I feel like Tom Riley, if he redrew this cover, could do it better. I think the inking on the smoke in the background and just the actual drawing of Duke and his head, it's very, very good. But having read the issue, I think he can do slightly better. And it sort of makes me wonder if this cover was like the first thing he drew, and then he got, you know, more warmed up on the character and the world and the stuff. But yes, but 9. Great writing, great color, great art, great lettering, great design. It's longer than a normal issue, has a bunch of references, and I don't want to say Easter eggs, but Easter eggs, and as you said, works in the Transformers. And there are some wordless silent panels. I always appreciate that. And the editorial at the end was great.
Good.
It wasn't just like, I'm excited. It was like, no, I can do this. All right.
And write a proper thing. Before we wrap up, let's just check in with messages from the listeners.
Postbox Bit, this is where you can send in your thoughts. Mark and Tim will hear it, and then we'll discuss it. It's really nice to hear from our biggest fans.
This week we have a returning listener message. This is Scotty Cameron chiming in with his thoughts on Duke.
Yo, Joe. Hello, Mark, Tim. Just got Duke number 1, and I gotta say, I was blown away. You know, I've been looking forward to this ever since it was announced back in June or July. But, you know, seeing that preview on Bleeding Cool, and then as the issues for Transformers, Void Rivals, and even A-Rock came out, seeing that little preview at the end, I was like, oh, I've gotta read this comic. It looks so good. And then actually reading it, I was impressed. I really like its use of 2-page spreads from that Man of Action one and then the one of Duke and Starscream. I also really like how Tom Riley recreated that bit from Transformers number 2 with Starscream from Duke's point of view, especially seeing Starscream crush Frosting in Duke's lenses. I also love our little introduction to Destro and Mercer. I bet Baroness is going to play into Destro's scheme of destroying Duke. I also love, at the end, we get a cameo from Covergirl, as well as a tease of Stalker and Rock and Roll, and how they both look like the classified figures. Well, now you know.
And knowing is half the battle. Flint out.
Great to hear from Scotty there, and likewise, all of you listeners out there, if you want to leave us a message, head on over to the Talking Joe website, talkingjoe.co.uk. Scroll down to the bottom and there is a button there, leave us a message. You can leave us very easily a short voicemail, which we can include in a future episode. Now, next time on Talking Joe, we will continue to cover the latest issues of A Real American Hero when they come out. 303 is the next one, coming out January the 17th. We will cover Cobra Commander issue 1 as that comes out in January. And we'll, I think, check back in on Duke as well before too very long. So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick and mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. talkingjoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/talkingjoe. So a big thanks to all our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.
All right, I'm going to scram. This has been great. What a good comic.